Just minutes from landing, Yemeni Flight 626 vanished into the Indian Ocean. Of the 153 on board, almost all perished. Today, we delve into this heartbreaking story, examining the factors that led to this tragedy. The Airbus A310 departed Sana'a, Yemen, bound for Moroni, Comoros. As the flight neared its end, a series of errors cascaded into disaster. Only a 12-year-old girl survived. What caused this seasoned crew to make such critical mistakes? Let's investigate the flight files of Yemeni Flight 626. Welcome everyone to the Flight Files. I'm Dan, and with me is my co-host, Tom. We are both aviation enthusiasts, not pilots, just to get that out of the way. So we are just interested in the things that go on in the aviation industry and find it fascinating when it comes to how these flights happen, because aviation is, of course, the safest form of transport.
Yeah, completely agree. We've got this interest in aviation. Yeah, I like seeing what goes wrong, why it went wrong. Obviously, stuff happens then, so hopefully it doesn't go wrong again in the future. I don't think I've heard of this one actually, so I'm quite interested to see what happens.
Brilliant. So let's jump straight into it then. So this is Yemen's national airline, and it has a history of questionable safety records and incident prior to this flight. So it was founded in the late 1960s, so it's quite an old airline, and it has had a few incidents in its history prior to the flight. And these, you know, they include a crash in 1972 where nearly all the passengers and crew were lost, which is devastating, as well as that they've had a few runway overruns and some non-fatal incidents over the decades. So, you know, it's a bit spotty. Their record isn't perfect, and you'll see why as we go through. The perception of it is that they are inconsistent with their safety, and they have, just to preface a bit later, I don't want to get too ahead of myself, they have been banned from flying into certain European countries at times because of the safety concerns of the airline itself.
Yeah, it sounds like they have potentially learned from their lessons, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And for such an old airline, you would think that over time they would have corrected any sort of safety issues that would have come with it. But again, don't want to get ahead of myself, don't want to spoil anything, but there are a few reasons why they continue to have these issues. So they were operating in a region where aviation oversight and regulations weren't as stringent than the more developed part of the world, you know, the US, Europe. There are massive regulatory boards that manage aviation across the Western civilization. And because of this, it might have contributed to a less than ideal safety environment for aircrafts and airlines that operate in these lesser financially prominent countries.
Yeah, I've always wondered what the sort of training is like with these, like the standards. Do you know what I mean? Training standards, maintenance standards. Obviously, it's financial, I guess, but can't put a price. Just quickly as well, I noticed you said the A310. What a plane.
Yeah, so this was the A310, which, just in case you don't know, the A310, for everyone listening, is a wide body, is a twin engine jet. It's popular for more medium to long haul routes. And at the time of this crash, the plane was 19 years old. So in aviation terms, not incredibly old, but getting towards the end of its lifespan, its service, you know, ability.
Yeah, proper maintenance obviously keeps them going. Stringent maintenance. I wonder if it was maintenance related. I'm intrigued.
So we'll get on to that in a bit, but you are not on the wrong track, I will say that. So just to give a bit more background about the A310, it was boomed in popularity between the 80s and 90s, and it started being phased out by a lot of airlines by the late 2000s. Obviously, Airbus brought in new aircraft, and Boeing started developing new aircraft as well, so the old style started phasing out. And at the time of the crash as well, the A310 had 53,587 flight hours and 18,129 cycles, a cycle being a full takeoff and landing.
I've been around the world.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 19-year-old plane. It's had a lot, and to be fair, with it being 19 years old, it's surprising, given the sketchy record of Yemeni Airlines, that it wasn't involved in a crash earlier or some sort of incident. So that's pretty good going, I'd say.
Yeah, I guess it shows how robust the planes themselves are, obviously, even with maybe a lacking maintenance sort of schedule, but they are built to last and survive, I guess.
Yeah. Exactly. And obviously, the time period as well is the late 2000s, when aviation standards were typically becoming more strict and stringent. The aviation regulatory boards were definitely at this time, and even more so now, a lot more robust in their processes and what they allowed and didn't allow. So it's unusual for a crash like this to happen so late on into aviation's life.
Yeah, one survivor as well. You've definitely got my interest going here, Dan, I must
yeah,
say.
It's a very, very tragic incident, losing almost all but one on board, and we'll get into that a bit later. But jumping into the flight route, so as I mentioned in the intro, it was from Sana'a, Yemen to Moroni, Comoros, and they had a stopover in Djibouti, and I really apologize if I pronounced that incorrectly, but the island nation of Comoros is in the Indian Ocean, so where the crash occurred. So they departed from Yemen, and Yemen is obviously located in the Middle East of the Arabian Peninsula, and Djibouti is a country at the Horn of Africa. So it's a strategic location, the seven entrance of the Red Sea, you geography buffs out there, just so you can get a footing of where we are. And the destination was Moroni, Comoros, which again, I apologize if I'm not pronouncing that correctly. And
I think you're doing better than I would, Dan, to be fair.
So it's an island nation in the Indian Ocean, like I mentioned earlier, and just located off the southeast coast of Africa and north of Madagascar. So relatively remote, and it was a fairly long flight. So the passengers, mainly Comorian nationals, returning home from visiting family and working in France. And the reason I say France is because there was a stopover in France.
Oh, very interesting.
So on board, we had Captain Khalid Hajeb. I'm just going to apologize one more time if I'm pronouncing these wrong. So their total flight hours were 7,936. And on the A320 in particular, they had 5,314 flight hours. They've been flying for Yemen since 1989. And they've been an Airbus A310 captain since 2005. So a significant amount of time. And the first officer, Ali Atef, has 3,641 flight hours at the time of the crash, and in the Airbus, that was their prominent plane, 3,076 hours, and they've been flying for Yemen since 1980, so only, 9 years before the captain of the flight, and they were qualified to fly the A310 since 2004.
Damn, yeah, so they're an experienced crew.
Yeah.
In total.
Definitely an experienced crew. And not many hours between them in terms of the A310 and how long they've been flying for the airline for. The first officer had been flying for longer, but didn't qualify for the A310 later. Qualified later than the captain for this flight.
Yeah. Interesting.
So, just to ask you now, any thoughts, given all just the limited information we have right now, what are your thoughts on what could have happened? What's the cause for the crash?
I don't know. I mean, there's loads of factors, I guess. What sort of could the crew, could it be sort of pilot error? Could it have been, you know, a maintenance issue causing a pilot error? Possibly. It could be weather related. I don't know when they were flying. Was it day or night time? Maybe they were tired. All these factors, I guess, could come into play, really. Am I on the right lines, maybe?
So, you are. You've mentioned, there was something you mentioned specifically there that I will, you'll find out in a minute when we go into the actual incident itself, but you are definitely on the right track.
Lovely.
Okay, so Yemen Flight 626 was coming in to Moroni. It was late at night. It was around 2:30 a.m. local time. So really dark. Weather conditions weren't great. It was really rainy and windy, so there was poor visibility and intermittent visibility as well because of the rain. And the lights of Moroni struggled to pierce through the darkness at night and the rain. So it made finding the airport, in particular, really tricky. Precise visibility reports for the time aren't readily available, but we can sort of infer based on the information that we do have that the visibility was quite poor. So as well as this, the crew could have potentially been facing a bit of fatigue because of this. Obviously, it's a really early morning landing, and the late night, the weather. There's a lot to handle, and they were experienced crew, but you know, there's always room for this sort of stuff. And the reports indicate that wind speeds were around 61 kilometers per hour or 38 miles per hour. So not outrageously dangerous, but they can definitely complicate when visibility is as low as it was.
Yeah, it sounds to me like it's putting the experienced crew to their sort of test. You know what I mean? This isn't a normal landing. This is what they've trained for. That they need to be on their game, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. This is putting everything they've learned as a pilot over their entire careers, like into, like they're putting it all into action right now. Like everything that could be against them is against them.
Yeah, were they? I might be jumping the gun, but I'm assuming they were using an ILS approach.
So I don't know if that was readily available.
Okay.
I couldn't find anything when I was researching this, incident, but this next bit may answer that question for us. So initially they missed the approach. So they attempted a landing and had to go around. So they made the go around decision because it struggled to maintain a stable approach path because of the turbulence and the crosswinds. 61 kilometer per hour winds are pretty intense. So they made the decision to go around, which is a common thing in aviation. If you don't know what go around is, it's basically when a pilot makes a decision, or ATC makes the decision for the aircraft to go around and attempt the landing again. It's a safety thing, and it's common. It happens all the time. When it happens, it's not something to worry about. It could just mean that you're not on the right glide path, so you need to just come back up, go around, try again.
Yep, they got, like you said, strict approach criteria that they've got to meet, and if they don't, they try again, and if they can't do it, they divert. It's as simple as that. Safe.
Yeah, exactly. So after this happened, there became a highlight for the potential issues that led to the crash after the go-around. So it's not sure what the exact instructions ATC gave to the crew, but it is assumed that there were some misunderstandings based on what was said. So typically when a go-around happens, they would have been put into a holding pattern at a specific altitude, and it basically allows the plane to circle just to wait for a better opportunity to land, because there might be multiple aircraft coming in, or they might just wait for weather conditions to clear up. So ATC will put them in a holding pattern, which is basically like a circle, so that they can land in more favorable conditions. But there was a few potential points of miscommunication between the crew and ATC. So typically, aviation is a English-based communication language, but there might have been some miscommunication between the crew and ATC. So after the missed approach, they would have put in a holding pattern, and they began struggling to maintain a stable flight path, again, because of the weather, because of the wind. It's not surprising. And the ATC may not have realized that the pilots were trying to configure the aircraft to land early instead of maintaining the holding pattern that they were put in.
Okay, interesting. I had a point then. I was going to say, I wonder what equipment the controllers had, because they might not have had, you know, up-to-date radar like there are these days. It might have been, you know, a blip on the screen every now and then, sort of tables in front of them. So maybe that was a factor. I don't know. I don't know what equipment they had.
It could potentially be a factor. It's not said in the incident here, in the incident report. However, that is definitely possible given the location where they were landing. You know, it's a remote island. It's not... I can't imagine there's a lot of aircraft heading there. So, yeah, the tech that they might have been working with probably wasn't as up to date as you would get in somewhere like Heathrow, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Interesting.
So this is where we start to get into what happened and the reason for the crash. So there was a series of events that caused the pilots to incorrectly configure the plane. The speed of the plane started decreasing drastically, and the stall warning started sounding on the aircraft shortly before it hit the ocean, not too far from the runway. So the pilots attempted to regain a stable approach and made a series of inputs, but those inputs put the aircraft in a dangerous situation. So they failed to maintain sufficient airspeeds, and they didn't select the correct flap settings for the landing approach. So the plane was descending too quickly, and it was most likely in an incorrect nose-up attitude.
Oh. So they had too much of an angle of attack, and yeah, bled their speed off too much. I guess as well, another factor, like you said, darkness. They've got no point of horizon apart from their instruments. They're in, you know, complete instrument rules. So time of day, stress with the go around, and tiredness. Like I said, this is where all their training comes into play. But yeah, damn.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the point I made earlier about the lights potentially not being able to pierce through the rain and you know, the thick darkness that was around them, they are completely reliant on their instruments. However, there were multiple stall warnings from the aircraft, and they sounded repeatedly telling them that the plane was likely losing lift and it was about to fall out of the sky. Obviously, it isn't just like a, you know, you drop a ball and it falls out. It kind of glides a little bit, but for the essence of storytelling, it falls out of the sky. But the pilots didn't seem to recognize the danger they were in and taking the necessary actions to avert the stall. And I think you're right, it might be because they don't have a point of reference of where they are in the sky. They're working on their instruments, but in a situation like this, they are probably focusing on so many other things that this is sort of the last thing they're thinking about. They might think they have so much time because they had to do a go around. They might be at altitude that they weren't clearly at.
Yeah, I've heard things in other reports as well before. I can't remember exactly what it is, but there's a phenomenon, if I can even say it correctly, where when you don't have a point of visual reference, it's something inside your ear, where, you know, with that sense that you're falling, sort of, your body obviously knows that you're falling because of deceleration, but also obviously they needed to accelerate, and there's something to do with that and your body sort of mixing the two up. So maybe they thought they were actually accelerating when they were decelerating. I can't remember. I'll have to try and find for next time, and I'll explain it a bit better. But maybe that had sort of come into play.
Yeah, potentially. And when the aircraft entered a full stall, its nose pitched up further and it just began to lose altitude really quickly. They attempted to recover the aircraft in the last moments before it was too late, essentially. But unfortunately, the A310 crashed into the Indian Ocean in a nose-up, slightly left banked position. And the force of the impact was devastating, leaving only one passenger who miraculously survived, and the survivor being a 12-year-old girl.
Damn. Did you say into the ocean? How did she... Did you say it crashed into the ocean? Or did it reach the runway?
So it crashed into the ocean. So she actually got ejected from the aircraft. And as she was ejected, she clung to a piece of debris in the ocean and basically just stayed there. She held on for her life and battling the waves and obviously what just happened to her and everyone else on board. And she was there for 10 hours before she was discovered by people.
What? That is insane.
So, yeah, obviously the ocean is freezing. It's pitch black. You were just involved in a plane crash and you were just thrown out of a plane and she survived, which is, you know, in terms of what happened, like, it's incredibly saddening what happened, but there is like a slight light in the darkness, I guess, that she was able to survive and she was resilient enough to survive.
Yeah, exactly. That's mad. That's actually... Yeah. I don't even know what to say. That's crazy.
I knew I picked a good one.
Yeah, that is a good one. She got ejected from the plane.
Yeah, I can't even imagine what that must have been like for her. And being 12 as well. I'm not sure if she was flying alone or if she was flying with family. It's not clear from what I can see. But yeah, that must have been absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. Damn.
So the investigation, basically, the official verdict was that Yamuna Flight 626 was pilot error. The cause of the crash was pilot error. There was a lot of contributing factors such as fatigue, inadequate training, which you mentioned earlier, and a possible misunderstanding of the Airbus stall systems. So there were a few, you know, domino effects that added up to cause the unfortunate disaster. And the fatigue was due to the pilots had been on duty for an extended period, possibly leading to impaired judgment and some slower reaction times. Obviously, when you're tired, when you've been up for longer than you should have, especially when you're flying a plane that takes so much concentration, it's going to lead to a lot of mistakes to happen.
Yeah, exactly. Just going back, Dan, did you say that this all happened during the go-around, so they didn't they didn't execute the go-around procedure correctly and entered the hold?
So that's what it's believed. So it's believed that they tried to configure the aircraft to land without before staying in the hold pattern for as long as they needed to, without ATC instructing them to try and land again.
Right, okay, that makes sense, yeah. Yeah, so they were almost in a landing config after a go-round, when they should have sort of cleaned the plane up, entered the hold, got vectored, and then another approach.
Yeah, exactly. As well as the fatigue, and, you know, this comes into the point that you just made, the investigation also suggested that the pilots may not have received sufficient training or current simulator practice. So with the A310 and the stall recovery techniques, they may not have been trained properly and may not have been on the sim long enough to understand the different recovery techniques to be used in the Airbus.
Yeah. I'm sure the... Oh, I don't know if I'm right or wrong here. I think the A310's a yoke, isn't it? So they must have had some sort of stick shaker.
Yeah, that would have been part of the stall warnings that were going off. So they most likely knew that the plane was stalling, but with the just relying on instruments, it was probably really hard for them to tell what was going on.
Yeah, they've just executed a go-round. So I imagine their sort of engines are flat out and their plane's telling them they're stalling, I guess, sort of contradicts itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And this may be the reason why. So there was an indication that they may not have fully understood the stall protection systems and its limitations, like mentioned earlier, which could have led them to inadvertently override the safety features that were in the A310.
Oh. Yeah, I guess it's not sort of what we're used to these days with the Airbus, like the A320's got the protection laws, so it was sort of I think one of them's alpha floor, so it almost prevents a stall itself, I believe. I guess that might not have been a feature back then.
Yeah, potentially, because this was a 19-year-old aircraft at this point, so it might not have been. But the main foundation of the investigation was obviously that it was pilot error, and it was likely a combination of different factors that led to this happening. As well as that, I don't have it in my notes, but I remember reading that the plane had a maintenance in France, and I'm not sure if I'm getting this wrong, so I might stop there, but I'm pretty sure the maintenance suggested that there were some issues with the plane.
Oh.
But again, it's not in my notes, so I'm gonna leave that there, and people can do their own look up of that singular point.
Yeah.
So the black box, they managed to find it, which is obviously they recovered the flight data recorder and the voice recorder. So the flight data recorder showed that there were a series of incorrect control inputs and missed corrective actions as the plane slowed to a dangerously low speed. And the cockpit voice recorder revealed a lack of communication between the pilots and a possible misunderstanding about the aircraft's state and the impending stall. So, like you said as well, and like I said earlier, it is most likely that they didn't fully understand the situation they were in at the time of the crash.
No. It's easy to... like quite a lot of these, it's easy to think, oh, why didn't they just execute a normal stall recovery? Well, not a stall recovery, sorry, a normal sort of go around. They're trained to do it, they know exactly what they're doing. But in these situations, that it's got to happen so quickly that they're all sort of memory items. And unless both pilots are sort of on their game 100%, then stuff like that can happen. I think these days the pilots do what's known as CRM training, sort of crew resource management, so that they're both on their game. They've got each person knows what their role is, and they both execute what they need to do in order to keep the plane safe. So maybe that's something that came out of this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's most likely that there was a lack of training across the board. And with the investigation just and the, you know, the black box that they found and the investigation that they did, it was definitely undeniable proof that it was pilot error that was the primary cause of the crash. And because of the lack of training and the fatigue, because of the extended service that the pilots were in at the time, was where the changes needed to be made to prevent similar tragedies. But as I mentioned at the start, Yemenia Airlines didn't have the best record going into this. When the crash happened, there was a lot of scrutiny towards the airline, mainly around the age of the aircraft, particularly in this incident, being 19 years old, and their maintenance practices, but also their fleet consisted of a lot of older aircraft, which people questioned the safety of them because obviously they weren't as up to date as, you know, the more modern planes that other airlines were using, and this might be a monetary thing, but people basically accused them of prioritizing profit over passenger safety. And there was a point where the airline was banned from flying into French airspace because of the safety concerns of their planes.
Wow. The older aircraft don't have the features that the new ones have these days that sort of prevent these things from happening. That's why newer planes have these safety features to hopefully not have this happen again. But was it just the French that that banned them in Europe, did you say?
I think they were banned across a few European countries, but this specifically states after the crash, that just for some context, that they were previously banned in France because of the concerns around their safety.
Yeah, that's not good, is it? That would probably put me off flying with them, but I mean, it might have been people's only choice, I guess, to get around.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the island, because there was a lot of residents from that island on board, it's probably one of the few airlines that actually travel there, so you're not really left with that much choice in those sorts of areas. But it was when this crash happened, it really shone a light on the differences between safety regulations and training across different regions of the world. And it highlighted that airlines operating in nations with less than robust oversight might face greater challenges in maintaining their safety levels to the highest level that they need to. As well as that, like you mentioned earlier, what equipment were they using? There were also some concerns around the resources, not modernizing their equipment, and the amount of reoccurring training that the pilots should be getting as they are in other parts of the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I think pilots, I mean, sort of European pilots get trained on different situations, I'm pretty sure, sort of 6 months to a year, like, you know, ruthless sort of training to make sure that when these situations happen, because they don't happen every day, like, I'm pretty sure most pilots in their career would probably only execute, you know, a dozen sort of go-rounds. It's very rare to happen, so when it does happen, they need to know what to do so that they can keep their passengers safe. And we've obviously got simulators these days which can allow that to happen without putting anyone at risk. So, you know, if that technology's there, we've got to use it. But the smaller airlines and different parts of the world may not have those resources available to them as much as we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And with that as well, there was a push for stronger collaboration worldwide to bring everyone up to the safety standards at a consistent level. And this was mainly due to a few things. So with the pilot fatigue, developed nations typically have regulations on the maximum amount of hours that you can fly and how long you need to rest before you can fly again. But it is theorized that those rules are a bit looser and they're a lot harder to enforce elsewhere. And there was also concerns around airlines in these, in these areas prioritizing profit and maximizing the flight schedules leading to overworked crews, which is a big concern for any airline, but typically, especially in these more developing nations. And it really shines a light on the differences between a plane and an airline operating out of the UK, for example, versus an airline like Yemenia, and the amount of strict safety protocols that British Airways is under at any given time.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine sort of, if the pilots said, we can't do this, this isn't safe, then that could be their job out the window, do you know what I mean? This being a pilot's a massive thing, but the training and the career is huge, so sort of going against the higher powers might not end too favourably for the pilots and the crew. So they might have just sort of had to put up with it, but it's not right, like you said. Working hours and stuff, I'm pretty sure medium long haul pilots definitely get a day's break between flying out and coming back to make sure that they are fully rested and that they're on their game, because they need to be. This sort of shows that.
Yeah, I mean, you have however many people on board. So this flight had 153 people on board. That's a lot of responsibility for a pilot and a first officer to have, and you need to be well rested. And it was very evident that the amount of pressure that they were under, the nighttime arrival, the weather that they were facing, they were having to cross multiple time zones, so it was a long haul flight, and their disrupted sleep cycles all led to their fatigue just getting worse and worse. But you're absolutely right. Like, they can't, I'd imagine they can't say no because they'd lose their job.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's not good. Are they still operating now?
I'm not entirely sure if they are, but I can have a quick look. It looks like they are still flying. They have a fleet size of 7 and they travel to 11 destinations. So they're still going, but lots of it. I'd be interested to see what that safety record is like now.
Yeah, what aircraft they've got. Maybe they've still got older aircraft. I'm quite intrigued to see what their maintenance is like, because if they're being a smaller airline, they're going to have to take on the older aircraft because of the price, but that means that their maintenance has got to be on top.
Yeah, maybe we can do a supplementary episode about the Yemeni and do a bit of digging into what planes they have and the age and their safety record now. I think that'd be quite interesting to do a bit of digging on.
Yeah, definitely. I agree.
But that was the incident. Obviously, it was really tragic. The fact that one 12-year-old girl was the sole survivor is incredible that she survived, but devastating that it happened. And with every incident like this, there is always a need in aviation to prevent it from happening again. So hopefully they took a lot of learning from this flight and they enforce a lot of stricter regulations moving forward to allow for these smaller, more remote airlines to bring them up to the standard of the international aviation industry.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you, like you said, if you compare it to, you know, American or European, I don't know if that crash would have happened. Do you know what I mean? The pilots would have sort of knew what they were flying into, briefed what they would do if they need to go around on approach, executed a go around because they're trained. It might not have had the same outcome, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this was a really interesting incident. I'm glad that you didn't know about it, because that always makes it more interesting to listen to, I find.
Yeah, definitely.
But I just want to go on. Sorry.
I've watched countless videos and listened to countless podcasts, and I've never heard of that one. So yeah, good pick.
Yeah, it's super interesting. But I just want to say thank you for everyone for listening to the second episode of our podcast, The Flight Files. This is really fun for us, and I'm definitely enjoying it so far. Next week, we will have Tom's incident, and I don't know what that is, but I'm very interested to find out. Any yeah, teasers? Do you have any on the horizon that you can maybe tease?
I don't actually, Dan. I'll be completely honest. I need to do some digging and see what I can come up with. I've got an idea of what I want to do. I might do. Have you heard of the MD-80?
No.
Donald Douglas.
Oh yes.
Famous or infamous for its safety records. So there should be a few incidents I can go at. Maybe I'll choose an older aircraft so we can sort of compare to what, like you have today, compare to what systems they had back then and what we've got back now. That might be interesting.
Yeah, that sounds good. I'm excited. But again, thank you everyone for listening. Follow on your preferred podcast provider. You know, there's loads. Wherever you listen to your podcast, you can just follow the podcast and rate it. That would be great. We'll be doing weekly episodes and some supplementary episodes as we go. And if you have any flights that you want us to take a look at, we'll work out a way for you to get those to us.
Yeah, good idea. Thank you, Dan, for your brilliant storytelling. I did enjoy it. Like I said, one I haven't heard of, so you got me on that one. But yeah, follow along for our weekly podcasts, and we'll see you next time.